One journey over his home state of North Carolina that covered more than 100 miles and lasted 14 hours. He usually sits in a chair, but today he was in a much sturdier basket. His balloon cluster has an airworthiness certificate and a registration plate. He described today's feat as a classic challenge. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Paris.
Actor Gary Coleman remains in critical condition at a Utah hospital. Relatives say he was admitted 2 days ago for a serious medical problem. There were no details released. Coleman is best known for his role on the hit sitcom Different Strokes, which ran from the late 1970s to the mid-80s. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org.
On the next Fresh Air, to kick off the holiday weekend, we have a funny interview with the creators of South Park, Trey Parker and Matt Stone. Their show has continued to be controversial.
There has been a lot of times where we've opened up the paper, pulled up the Drudge Report or something, and it's like, South Park does this, and you're like, oh God, what do we do? And you find out from the paper.
Yeah.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
And this is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour, we'll go to the archives for a program we first broadcast in February of 2009. So as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the life of a man who was quite well known in America in the 19th century. His name was Clarence King. He was a geologist, well known as an explorer and surveyor of the West. He was a best-selling author. When the U.S. Geological Survey was created, he was the first head of the survey, and was someone certainly was a very high-profile individual at this time in America in his day. He was also a man with a secret. For 13 years, he lived a double life, both as the celebrated white explorer and as a black Pullman porter and steelworker named James Todd, and he did it so that he could be with the woman that he loved. We'll bring you this story this morning as we talk with historian Martha Sandweiss, and she has written about this in a newly published book. And the title of her book is Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. The Penguin Press is the publisher, and the book is out now, and it's a very interesting story. A little bit more about our guest, Martha Sandweiss, is professor of history at Princeton University. She began her career as a museum curator, and she also taught for 20 years at Amherst College. She has written many works on Western American history and also the history of photography, including the book Print the Legend, Photography and the American West. She is also the co-editor of the Oxford History of the American West. Professor Sandweiss, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, David.
Well, thanks for talking with us. It's a fascinating, fascinating story, so I'm glad you could give us some of your time. If you were interested in finding out something about Clarence King and you went to look him up, and you just what you were starting out with was just the, sort of a standard one-paragraph encyclopedia entry about this man, what sort of things would you see?
You would probably learn that he was the most distinguished, one of the most distinguished American scientists of the late 19th century. You would learn that he walked across the continent as a young man in 1863, that he was one of the first explorers of the Sierras out in California, that he wrote a best-selling book about that. And then you would learn that as a young man of scarcely 25 in 1867, shortly after the close of the Civil War, he invented a system for mapping the West. And he conceived the great project of federal surveys that helped map the Western landscape in the 1860s and 70s, and he later became the first director of the United States Geological Survey.
So that's just the standard. That's what you would find, and perhaps at the time, that's what a lot of people would have known, people who knew him. That's Clarence King.
Exactly. He was also renowned as a talented writer and as one of the wittiest speakers, wittiest after-dinner speakers in all of New York. and his dear friend John Hay, who had been a personal secretary to Abraham Lincoln and who later became the Secretary of State, called King the best and brightest man of his generation.
And certainly he moved in some exalted circles. He would have been close friends with a number of the noted elites of his time.
Exactly. John Hay was a close friend. The historian Henry Adams was a very close friend. And he counted among his friends some of the nation's most distinguished artists, writers, and politicians.
So then if we ask this question, well, you wouldn't find him in the encyclopedia, but if I said to you, who was James Todd? What sort of answer could you give?
Well, there were some real James Todds. It's not that unusual a name, but you certainly wouldn't find this James Todd in any of the historical records.
This was something that maybe was not widely known, but over time, certainly it did become known, and certainly it became more publicly known in the 30s when Ada, the woman we're talking about, and we'll talk more about him, there was a legal action where she was trying to secure what she believed was a kind of a legacy that he had left for her and the children. But it seems as if that over time, people who did know about this or people who wrote about him were just, to use the cliche phrase, they just swept this under the rug. Nobody really wanted to talk about this.
Well, some scholars have addressed the fact that King did have a long relationship, whether it was a marriage or not, they weren't quite sure, with an African-American woman. But I am the first scholar to uncover the evidence that King himself was trying to live as a black man in his secret life.
Mm-hmm. Do we know how it is that he came to meet Ada Copeland?
Well, that's one of those things we really have to speculate about here. Ada Copeland had been born into slavery in West Georgia, probably on a small cotton plantation, and she came alone to Manhattan in the mid-1880s and secured work as a nursemaid, which meant she would have lived with a white family and taken care of their children. So where could Clarence King have met her? I don't think he could have met her in her employer's house, even if her employers were his friends, and we don't know who they were, because he would have walked in the front door and been the famous Clarence King. He couldn't walk in the back and tell this woman he was a working man named James Todd. So I think they would have had to have met in a public place, on a trolley, on a street, in a park.
And this reflects one aspect of his character. It seems that he, wherever he happened to be, maybe this was in London, for example, or it was in New York City, places like that, he was dividing his time, in a sense, between hobnobbing and spending time with the kind of people that you talked about initially, the elites of the time. And then when he was on his own time, he liked to live and walk through a very different kind of world.
Yes, Clarence King liked to go, to use the word of the time, slumming. He liked to go into working-class neighborhoods, to go into bars, to go into coffee houses, and to just sit down and talk with people who were utterly different than himself. And he was attracted to working-class life, and it bears saying that he was also attracted to women of color. His friends noted that he liked to flirt with women in coffee shops in New Orleans or Cuba. He himself noted that he was attracted to Indian women in California or Native women in Hawaii. So this was something that his friends knew a small bit about, but they really didn't know how far he took it.
Mm. Just now to take a few steps back, talk a little bit about the family into which he was born and his upbringing.
Well, Clarence King was born in Newport, Rhode Island in 1842 to a quite distinguished family that traced its ancestry back to the signers of the Magna Carta. His great-grandfather was a United States senator who helped establish the Smithsonian Institution. His grandmother was a noted abolitionist who was a friend of the great Frederick Douglass. And his own father was a China trader, which is to say he was often away from home on sailing ships out in the Pacific. And young Clarence scarcely knew his father, who in fact died when the boy was only five. So he really grew up in a household of women, his abolitionist grandmother and his very protective and ambitious mother.
Hmm. So as a young man, he was really steeped in opposition to slavery?
He was an abolitionist himself, but he was enrolled as a student in the scientific school at Yale in the early 1860s when the Civil War broke out. And although some of his friends were eager to go join the fight, King himself was not. And rather than go south when he graduated from college, he decided to walk west.
Hmm. What did he later on say or write what he thought about the war and that he had chosen not to participate that way?
He really didn't like to engage that. I don't think he wanted people to question his patriotism or his bravery. But I think in addition to inheriting a streak of abolitionism from his grandmother, he also inherited her Quaker pacifism. And I think war was just something that seemed repellent to him.
Mm. As you mentioned, he studied at Yale. How did he become interested in geology?
Well, geology was an evolving science at the moment that he was studying it. When he enrolled at Yale, although Darwin's work on evolution had just come out, it really hadn't seeped into the scientific curriculum yet. At Yale, geologists were still studying the Christian theory of earth science. But King entered into the debate about geology at a moment when geologists were trying to figure out how the earth was formed. Was it a slow, gradual evolution, a kind of geological counterpart to Darwin's theories, or was the earth shaped by what King called catastrophism, violent upheavals that altered the shape of the earth? And he took a position somewhere in between.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Martha Sandweiss. She's well known as a historian of the American West. She's now teaching at Princeton University. Before that, she taught for a long time at Amherst College. She is the author of the newly published book, Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. It's published by the Penguin Press. And the central figure here in this story is a man named Clarence King, who was one of the most, if not the most, distinguished American scientist of the late 19th century, very well known as a geologist and explorer and surveyor of the American West, was the first director of the U.S. Geological Survey. And as she has explained, someone who also for the last something like 13 years of his life lived this double life, had this dual identity, and apparently did it so he could be with this woman that he met and fell in love with, Ada Copeland. They were together for 13 years. They had 5 children. And one of the features of this story is that Ada, of course, we really don't know what it is she knew and what it is she thought, but it was not until King was dying and in another state, another part of the country, that he wrote a letter to her revealing who he really was and the fact that that he was not what it was he had said.
That's exactly right. King had gone to Phoenix in 1901 in a last desperate hope to recover from the tuberculosis that had made him so ill. And as he lay on his deathbed, he composed a letter to his wife, and effectively it said, "My name is not really James Todd. My name is Clarence King." And this part always makes me laugh. He directed his wife to write it in the family Bible in case she forgets it, and asked her to change the children's names as well. As if you could forget such a stunning revelation about the man you'd been married to for 13 years.
You have to, and you certainly raise this question, you have to wonder what Ada actually thought about this man and the fact that, for example, she never met his family, that he was gone a lot of the time, and even just who he said he was and who he looked like. It just doesn't seem to square up really well. And you would have to say, now truly, at the very first time, if you can possibly imagine the first time that Clarence King and Ada Copeland would have met, was he from this very first moment spinning out this story of this other identity? And what did she think?
Well, those are all great questions. I think that Clarence King had to have his alternative identity in mind from the very first moment he met her. Because when he introduced himself to her the very first time, he had to have said, "My name is James Todd, I'm a Pullman porter, and I'm a black man." Now, all Pullman porters were black. If he was in fact a Pullman porter, he must be a black man, because only African Americans were hired to work as porters on the Pullman railroad cars. That's one thing. Another thing I would say is that Ada Copeland was a savvy person. She's living in New York, and I'd bet that she knows lots of people of African-American descent who are living as white people. That means she knows that people who have African-American relatives can have very fair skin, and she understands that African-American skin can shade from very light to very dark. Her own skin was very dark. Now, the man who called himself James Todd, what did he look like? sandy brown hair, blue eyes, very, very light complexion. But in the late 19th century, your racial identity was determined not just by what you looked like, but by who your ancestors were. Because throughout the South, in the aftermath of emancipation and the freeing of the slaves, many states passed laws that said this: if one of your 8 great-grandparents is black, you can be legally categorized as black and consigned to ride in the Jim Crow cars. Your complexion didn't matter.
Hmm. And I suppose it's, you know, it's also true that perhaps at this time in America as well, that being white was something that was in a large part socially determined. Southern European immigrants weren't really considered white, and in the social sense, you have to put that in quotes. And I think it's interesting. One of the reviewers who reviewed the book made the observation that it was hard to imagine a man that was more white, quote unquote, in the social sense, than Clarence King, in the sense that he was a person who moved among the elites of society. He was one of those people. He came from a very old American family, well-established American family, and that so he was very white. It offers a remarkable and contrast to think of the, you know, his being able to maintain these two identities. But maybe in a sense, if you think, again, if you try to think more about how people thought about whiteness at that time in America, then maybe it actually starts to be less, seem less strange and starts to seem a little bit more plausible.
Well, you know, I sometimes think that his white-looking skin was the proof that he was a black man. Because, look, usually people pass towards privilege. You adopt a particular identity so that you could have greater legal freedoms or social freedoms. So why would anybody who looked like Clarence King did claim to be a black man unless he really was?
And then I think it opens up a really interesting area that is, as you say, certainly we know of many people, and I'm sure many people that we don't know of, African-Americans who lived as white.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to wonder how many people made the decision to cross the color line going the other way, and how many white Americans, for whatever reasons, maybe they were the same reasons as Clarence King, and we just don't know about them, how many white Americans actually made the decision to live as black?
Well, we know that some did. Some white Americans claimed black racial identities in order to marry people they loved in states where interracial marriage was illegal. And I would add that it was not illegal in New York when Clarence King married in 1888. Some people have adopted different racial identities to get other sorts of political or economic advantages. But as far as I know, King is the only public figure in all of American history to try to pull this off.
Yeah, and certainly because of who he was, there was no way that he could have openly married and lived with Ada.
Well, legally he could have.
Well, in that sense, there was no way that he could have done that without destroying his career and his reputation.
That's exactly right. I think he truly feared the social approbation that would follow upon such an act. And in all honesty, he couldn't afford scandal. The only way he could support his black or his African-American wife and their mixed race children was by going out into the world as the famous white mining consultant, engineer, scientist named Clarence King. Only Clarence King could earn enough money to support James Todd's family.
Yeah. And I suppose that then does say something about, it must say something about the depth of his feelings for Ada, that he would put himself in this situation, that he would take that sort of risk. So I guess all that one can conclude was that he did truly deeply love her, and that relationship was so important to him that he was willing to go to these lengths to be able to be with her.
Well, a few love letters that he wrote to her survived, and they do suggest that he was passionately in love with her. He writes her from the road, "You know, my darling, I lay awake at night and look at the stars and think only of you." Or, "My darling, I love this letter because I know it was touched by your hand." They're quite passionate letters. And I think you're exactly right that his life became extremely stressful. It would have been very hard to pull this off because it was a double game of deceit. His well-to-do white friends never knew about this family, and Ada and the children never knew about his public life.
Hmm. So when he was not, as far as Ada was concerned, when he was not there, she just believed that he was working, and I suppose the employee of the being a Pullman porter would have meant that he actually would have been gone for long periods of time because he would be off riding the train.
Exactly. It was a brilliant lie. It not only explained why he was gone from home so much and affirmed that he was a black man, it explained his worldliness, because, of course, Clarence King knew a lot about the world, and it explained why he seemed to have a pretty good middle-class income, because Pullman porters really led middle-class lives within the black community.
And then, though, for his white friends, for all of those people who knew him as Clarence King, he no doubt had ended up disappearing for periods of time when he was off living with Ada and the kids. What did they think he was doing, or where did they think that he was?
King was the most frustrating friend you could imagine. He was always disappearing or not answering your mail or not showing up for dinner when he was supposed to. But he was so charming, so generous, so interesting, so witty. His friends always forgave him. But they could never quite understand why he was so broke all of the time, because they had no idea that he was not only supporting his grandmother, his widowed mother, but a wife, four children, and a household of servants to take care of them.
Yeah. And that, I suppose, it makes the important point that even though he was born into this old Newport, Rhode Island family and was born into an advantaged life because of that, it was not a wealthy one. The family wasn't wealthy, so it wasn't as if he was a blue blood in the sense of the family and the family name, but this was not a wealthy family. He was not a wealthy man because of it.
That's a good point. And throughout the 1860s and 1870s, during the greatest years of his scientific career, he's working for the federal government. So he's not being particularly well paid at that moment. And in fact, one of the reasons he steps down from his job as director of the United States Geological Survey in 1881 is to make more money and to become an independent mining consultant. And unfortunately, that's just a very unsteady and uncertain sort of career.
We're already at our midpoint here, and let me just we have a caller we will take in just a moment. I do want to introduce again, though, our guest, Martha Sandwise. She's professor of history at Princeton University, and before that taught for 20 years at Amherst College, and she's written a lot about the history of the American West and also the history of photography. One other book that you might find interesting, you might want to look at, is her book, Print the Legend, Photography in the American West. She is also co-editor of the Oxford History of the American West. And if you would like to read this story that we're talking about here this morning, a story of Clarence King and his dual life, you should look for her book, Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. That's the subtitle. And the publisher on the book is Penguin Press, and it's just recently out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone to talk with in Champaign. And this is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Would you please explain how you became aware of this fact?
Okay, I'd be happy to. I've known about Clarence King for a long time. Many, many years ago when I was in graduate school, I read a quite wonderful biography of him that was written in the 1950s. And this biography, which was about 400 pages long, included only about 4 pages about Ada and the children. And that just bothered me, 4 pages to deal with a family life that lasted for 13 years. So the story has been in the back of my mind for a long time. But a few years ago, I decided to go back and see if I could learn anything more about this secret family life. And American census records had just been digitized. And I went on the computer in my office and decided to look up James Todd, King's alternative identity. And within just a few moments, I found a record of him living as a black man. And nobody had ever even imagined that possibility before. And that compelled me to go back and see if I could write this story.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned the fact that there were some surviving letters, that Clarence had written to Ada. Was there more material either that you found that nobody else had had known about, or was it just that material was there if you went looking for it and no one really had done very much mining of that for what could be found?
Oh, I think both of those things are true. I did find Ada and Clarence's great-granddaughter. And the truly extraordinary thing is that this woman, who's more or less my age, knew Ada Copeland Todd King, because we haven't talked about this yet. But Ada King, who was born into slavery in 1860, did not die until 1964.
That just amazes me. She lived to be 103.
Right. Her lifetime spanned that long century from Civil War to civil rights. And, of course, what that means is that she was alive when the great biography of Clarence King was written in the 1950s. But that biographer, I think, really was fascinated with King as a man of science, as a kind of hero of Western exploration. And he simply didn't want to investigate too hard those aspects of his hero's life that he thought were less than attractive. Hmm. But he could have found Ada King and he could have interviewed her. So what an opportunity was lost there.
Yeah. As we've mentioned, the two of them, Clarence and Ada, lived together, husband and wife, for 13 years. They had five children. I'm curious about their children and then their children. So it would be the children of Clarence and Ada and then their grandchildren. Did they live as white or as black? Or did some do one and some do the other?
Well, yes, their fate shows just how complicated race has been in this country for such a long time. One of the five children died as a toddler. The rest grew to adulthood. In 1913, the two girls got married, and they married in City Hall in Manhattan, and I know they married without their mother because they each married white men, and each girl swore for the other on the official New York City forms that the bride was white, because forms asked you at that moment to designate the race of the bride and the groom. So they married as white women. But just a few years later, their two brothers registered for the draft in World War I, and they were assigned to segregated Jim Crow regiments in the military. One of those boys died in a hospital categorized as a white man. So the racial history of this family has become very complicated. But I might just add, it's also in some ways rather tragic. Clarence and Ada King had only one grandchild by blood. This was a daughter that Ada King raised. And she raised her black. The girl later passed as white, married a white man, and in the 1950s was afraid to have a baby because of the human stain. She feared that her own African ancestry might be made visible in the face of her child. So she adopted a white infant instead, and that's the end of the family.
Is there any surviving record that would say what, among the children, you talked about the fact that that Clarence and Ada had, there were two girls, they got married, and when they got married, they said they're white, and they married white men. Mm-hmm. And that the boys, though, as far as the army was concerned, they were black, although I think you said one of them, when he died, was classified as white, so that just shows how much confusion there is. But of any sort of feeling about how within the family the feeling was, particularly I'm interested in, you know, the relations between the brothers and the sisters, because I'm sure that there were times when within African-American families, if someone decided they were going to live as white, that divided the family, that those people were sort of considered to be disloyal or traitors or something like that for having gone off to live as white. How did the siblings here sort that out, or do you know?
No, I do know, and that's a great question. One of the girls who married white divorced that husband after just a few years and moved back home with her mother and her brothers, and she remained in that house the rest of her life. The other sister, who had married white, died in childbirth just a few years later. So Ada King lives in this house that she moves into in 1902 until 1964, and her surviving son and surviving daughter continue to live there another two decades until their death.
One of the things that I want to make sure we talk about is what happened now in the 30s, in the early 1930s, because Clarence, when he died, said to Ada, you know, I have provided for you. I want to make sure that you and the children are going to be okay. And that ultimately there was a legal case. She, Ada, went to court because she felt that she was not getting what had been provided for her. What's the background of that case?
Yeah, well, when Clarence King dies in late 1901, and at the time, Ada is living in Toronto with the children because her husband had said, go there, it's a better racial climate, the children can get a better education there. So she receives a letter from Clarence King's doctor saying that Clarence King has died. Her husband, James Todd, has died. She returns to New York, and what is she going to do? She's just learned that her husband wasn't who he said he was. She's alone with four small children, all under the age of 10, and she needs to put her life back together. I think Clarence King had told one friend about his secret family, an old friend named James Gardner, who was a high school friend who had also become a geologist and been out west with him. Ada Todd puts an ad in a New York newspaper looking for this man. She doesn't even know of another way to find him. She contacts him. And then every month for 32 years, she gets a check in the mail. A few months after her husband's death, someone helps her buy a home in Flushing, and the checks continue every month. But she wants the body of the trust fund. She's a grown woman. She doesn't need to be treated this way. And for decade after decade after decade, she hires lawyers to go after the trust fund. After a while, every lawyer drops her case. But finally, in 1933, she gets her day in court. She has to prove she's married. She reads King's love letters out loud in court, which created a kind of scandal, and explains that they had been married by her minister within an African-American church. But no one will tell her where this money comes from. Finally, the judge rules King was broke when he died, and I believe that was true. And it turns out that the money Ada and her children had gotten every month for these 32 years came from King's good friend, John Hay, who had been Secretary of State, later from his widow, later from their children. And it was really hush money to keep the story secret.
Well, and was that ultimately King's money, or was it John Hay? Was he doing this either out of loyalty to his friend, or maybe because Clarence King, was it the case that he made some arrangements and said, look, after I'm gone, I want you to look after Ada and the children, and will you do that for me?
King had nothing in his estate when he died. He was actually deeply in debt to John Hay, who had been a very generous friend. I don't believe King ever told John Hay about the secret family. Hay learned about it only after King's death. So it was John Hay was had married a very wealthy woman, and they had no money troubles. So this was really charity from John Hay for all these years.
And no doubt it was what John Hay thought he was doing was he was protecting the memory and the reputation of Clarence King by doing what he could to both to take care of Ada and the children, but to do it in a way so that this would not become widely publicly known that Clarence King had this other family and this other life.
Exactly right. And the moment that the source of the money was revealed in court, the monthly payments stopped.
So what? How did Ada live from that point on? Because she, at that point, she was, as you said, she lived all the way until 1960. It's still sort of amazing to me that she lived all the way until 1964.
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing. She lived long enough to hear Martin Luther King give his great "I Have a Dream" speech about the Red Clay Hills of Georgia, and that's where she was from. She lived modestly. Her adult daughter and that daughter's second husband lived in the home with her. Her adult son, who was a musician and played around New York in various orchestras, lived there as well. And the family people there took care of one another.
Hmm. He just, you know, the more you read about him, the more you think that here Clarence King was, I guess to say the least, you would say an eccentric character, but certainly a remarkable character, and someone who really was all of these things, was obviously a very brilliant and energetic guy, lived this wild sort of life of the explorer and the mountain climber and the figure in the American West at the time, and had all these other interesting interests. It just comes off as really, the more you know about him, the more complicated the character becomes, and I think actually the more interesting as a person he becomes.
Yeah, I would say one thing that unites the two halves of his life is a penchant for risk.
Mm.
Certainly what he was doing with this alternative identity in New York was very risky, and his friends out west would comment on his bravery and the risk-taking he would take as an explorer. But his friends always said he was a man of paradox, and I don't think they fully appreciated just how paradoxical his views were. He loved being from Newport. He joked that he wanted it inscribed on his gravestone that he was aristocratic to the core. And yet he held incredibly radical racial views. He truly believed that miscegenation, as he called it, was the future of America. And he said that that America cannot achieve its greatness until there is truly an American people, no more English or German, as he said, no more Negro or white, but one true American race. And an idea like that was truly heretical in the mid-1880s when he wrote it.
I'm interested in having you talk about some other aspects of his life. Particularly, can you tell the story of the diamond hoax that he uncovered?
Well, King earned a reputation in his day as the King of Diamonds. In 1872, a field of extraordinary wealth had been found somewhere in the West. Everywhere, people were investing in this field, which was said to include diamonds and rubies and emeralds. King was a geologist. This didn't quite sound right, that all of those things would be found together in the same field, and he had just surveyed this part of the West. And so he secretly goes out there, finds the field, discovers it's been salted, that is, the gems aren't naturally occurring, but somebody has put them there. And he races back to San Francisco and exposes this huge fraud, thereby saving many, many people their fortunes.
And that this must have further contributed to his renown in the United States, the fact that he had done this.
Exactly. And it showed that scientists could become popular figures and that science could serve the public interest. And that was quite important.
But tell us just a little bit more about it, what he did in the West in terms of exploring and surveying.
Well, as a very young man, just out of school, as I said, he walked across the continent, and he joined up with the scientists on the California State Geological Survey who were trying to map the Sierras. And King became one of the very first explorers in Yosemite. And he wrote a best-selling book about this called Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada, a book which has been continually in print since 1872, and it's just a wonderful adventure story. But later, he invents something called the 40th Parallel Survey, which was a federal expedition that was intended to survey from the Sierras east to the Rockies and to kind of figure out what's there, what kind of natural resources are there, because the Transcontinental Railroad is about to be completed and Americans will have new access to this relatively unknown part of the country. And his survey, which went on for 6 or 7 years, became the model for the ones led by John Wesley Powell and others that helped map the West in the 1860s and 70s.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just again, for anybody who might have tuned in, to introduce our guest, Martha Sandwise. She's professor of history at Princeton University, has written a lot about the history of the American West, and is author of this new book about the life of Clarence King. The title of her book, Passing Strange. It is published by the Penguin Press, out now if you'd like to take a look at it. And of course, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So how is it that he came to be the first person to head the U.S. Geological Survey?
Well, when King founded his survey in the mid-1860s, other people got in line and started creating their own surveys. Some were military, some were civilian surveys. And it was kind of a great moment in American science, but a chaotic moment in American science. Sometimes these survey teams would crisscross in the field and end up surveying the same stretch of land. So in the 1870s, King and others began to realize that we could make science more rational and more efficient by bringing these competing surveys, and they were competing for federal funds, under one umbrella organization. And that truly was a brilliant idea, and the USGS remains an important agency in the federal government. Hmm.
I think maybe we're getting another caller here lined up, and yes, we do. Someone on our line number 4, we will talk with them. Newman, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just a quick question. I was curious about the age of the two individuals. Was he a lot older than her, or what was their age differential? I'll hang up a little.
Okay.
Thank you. Good question. King was about 18 years older than his wife. He was born in 1842, and she was born in 1860.
And is that something? It's something her birth date. We are fairly certain about.
Well, great question. Because since she was born into slavery, she did not, of course, have a birth certificate. But later, when her children were born, she consistently told the doctors who filled out their birth certificates that she had been born in 1860. And I know from her great-granddaughter that her birthday was in December. Hmm. Okay. So it's an informed historical speculation.
So, when we've talked, I've mentioned a couple of times that she died in 1964 and that she was 103. So you feel it might not be that she was exactly 103, but somewhere in that, you would say somewhere in that neighborhood, she probably was over 100 years old.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things I'm just curious there is in the book, you really, because there's not a lot of information, we know a lot about Clarence King, but about this part of his life and about Ada Copeland and who she was and what her life was and the circumstances under which they met, we really don't know. So you have to engage in some speculation. And I don't know how, as an historian, I'm sure that really what you would like is hard facts to base the writing on. In this particular case, you've got blank spots that you have to fill in. And I guess I'm just wondering how it is that you think about that and how you try to fill in those blanks and imagine a life for these people when you truly don't have the firsthand information.
Well, great question. I face two particular challenges. One is I know much more about King than I do about his wife, mm-hmm. and I wanted to make them equal characters in my book. The other problem, of course, is that King fought very hard to make sure there would be no public record of his secret life. He destroyed the letters his wife sent him. He was married by a minister because he didn't want to put his name on a civil marriage license. He never allowed the two of them to be photographed together. So, yes, those are the challenges. And you're absolutely right. Many times I wished I was a novelist so that I could just imagine what these two people were thinking and I could narrate with splendid omniscience what was in their heads. But I am an historian, and that means I live and die by my footnotes. So I've tried to be very careful in writing this to not only document all of my facts, but to clearly signal to my readers when I know something and when I am engaging in informed historical speculation. So I might say they might have met in a public place, on the street perhaps, or in a trolley. And that's supposed to signal to you that that's my best guess of how it could have happened, but I don't actually know.
Mm-hmm. You certainly are able to, we do know what life in the late 1880s in New York was like. And one can certainly, for someone like Ada, you could imagine with some accuracy what her life would have been like, because we would have known what life for someone like that would have been like at the time.
Right. Even if I can't know what she's thinking on a particular day, I can know enough to be certain that when she walked outside her apartment on a hot summer afternoon, she would be assaulted by the smell from the slaughterhouse that was across the street. Or I might not know what she said to her children one day, but I can know that in December, when a blizzard felled all the utility lines on her street, she would have been inside an apartment with them that was very cold and very dark. Mm-hmm. So I can't always know what's inside her head, but I can often understand the world that's revolving around her.
Yeah. All right, let's talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois. This is line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. I've got a question that you were kind of alluding to a little while ago about crossing paths with different other surveyors. Did he have any relationship with Powell during that time since, they were kind of out there somewhat at the same time anyway?
Yes, they were associates. For a while, they were competing against one another for congressional appropriations. And then when King did step down from the United States Geological Survey, Powell succeeded him as director of the agency. So I would say they were associates. They weren't particularly close friends simply because their paths just didn't cross that much.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Martha Sandwise. She's professor of history at Princeton University and has written a lot about the history of the American West and has also now produced this new book that's about the life of Clarence King, The Passing Strange, is the title of the book. Going back, I suppose the thing that I find myself going back to is this relationship between Clarence and Ada, and how it looked to Ada, and how it is that she was so willing to accept that he was who he said he was. That is, he was James Todd, a black Pullman porter. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that, the way that I think about it is, as you've said really clearly, he must certainly have loved her very much and wanted to be with her, could not marry her and live with her openly, and so chose this risky path, perhaps in part just because he was a man who liked risk, but also because he knew that that was the only way to do it. And to take the risk that he did must have said something about how he felt about her. And I suppose that you might look at that on the other side and say, well, maybe this also says something about how she felt about him, that something about him attracted her from the beginning, and she truly fell in love with him, and perhaps felt that he was a good man. He was a good father. He was a good provider. They had a good life. So one maybe wonders, well, would it have mattered to her whether he was exactly what he said he was? Or perhaps that we can go back to the thought that it was not something that she would have questioned.
Well, I don't think she would have asked too many questions for a couple of reasons. One, remember, she was born into slavery. She was born into an abysmal situation. And here's a man who's giving her children, a home of her own. She doesn't have to work for other people anymore. She has a true middle-class life. But this is what makes me imagine that she really believed him to be a person of African-American descent. Even in New York in the late 19th century, where the racial laws were less sharply etched than in the South, an interracial marriage would call attention to itself and would make her life difficult. If she really imagined herself married to a white man, her life was going to be hard. Mm-hmm. But if she understood herself to be married to a very light-skinned African-American man, she was kind of moving up on the social scale. And as Ada King's children begin to get a little bit older, she begins to step out into the world a little bit more. She actually has parties covered in the African-American press in New York. And that affirms for me that she felt quite secure in her identity as a middle-class African-American matron married to an African-American man.
Hmm. And just you made the point earlier that while there would have been places, certainly there were places in the United States at this time where interracial marriage was illegal, it would have been legal in New York, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that people would have approved.
Exactly.
One more caller here at least in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
What a bizarre story. I'm surprised I really don't know about this person, but I was wondering if anybody's doing a screenplay of this. I mean, it is perfect for a Western or whatever. And then I know you're a Western historian as well, so what's your opinion of the work of the photographer Edward Curtis? So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, I will say that I have had interest from some film companies in the few weeks since the book's come out, so stay tuned and we'll see what happens there. Edward Curtis is a person I very, very much admire. I think he tried to document basically all of Western North American Indian life in the early 20th century because he feared it would disappear. He was a romantic, but I think that he truly made a historically important record of Native life during the first few decades of the 20th century.
Okay. Again, if someone wants to call real quick, I'm sure we can get in a question, maybe two, before we end up out of time. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. There's something that I think about it. I come back to it, I guess, this idea again and again as I have the opportunity to talk with people about stories who have written about this time in America. The thing I, for myself, I guess I keep coming to is that this time that is the sort of the late 19th century is a really interesting time in America. And perhaps it is because this time seems to have a foot in two places. That is, America is starting to become modern America. And so we're moving towards where we are now. And yet at the same time, it's not. It straddles these two worlds. And particularly, I think, urban life at this time, and maybe one of the oddest, most exciting, interesting, strangest places would have been New York City. that there's something about this time that's just that I think is just really very compelling.
That's a great point. Look, they could keep this a secret because there was no telephones were rare. There was no radio. There was no television. There were lots of newspapers, but they were almost never illustrated. So that speaks to sort of the earlier 19th century side of things. But on the other hand, King couldn't have lived his secret life without the Brooklyn Bridge, which was constructed not long before he married Ada Copeland, because the Brooklyn Bridge connected Manhattan, where he lived as a white man, and Brooklyn, where he lived as a black man. And he got around on trolleys and trains. So, yes, that sort of modernizing side of New York made it possible for him to do this, but that older side of New York allowed him to keep it a secret.
Yeah, that, and perhaps also the other thing is, and maybe it says something about this time, that we could have figures like him. We have so many that seem larger-than-life figures, and it doesn't quite seem that we have people like that anymore.
Well, we might have them, but I don't think they could pull off a secret life like this for 13 years anymore. The media is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, yes, I suppose that's true. No, there is no such thing as a secret life anymore. What just we've gotten to the point here where maybe you have about a minute or so left, I guess, just now that you've really gotten the chance to get pretty deeply, certainly more than a lot of other people, into the life of Clarence King. What is it that you would say as a character that you find interesting, compelling, intriguing about him?
Well, I think his life really shows us just how fluid and arbitrary racial identity can be in American culture. It shows that it can be determined by context, a Pullman Porter's coat. It can be determined by ancestry, a story about your great-grandfather, as well as by your appearance. And given that the stakes for racial identity have been so high in terms of legal consequences for people, it's just really come to seem amazing to me how fluid and arbitrary those identities can be.
Mm. And within the family, is this something now that I guess you said that really the sadly enough that this line, this family really dies out, and it has something to do with the fact that there were constraints about how people could live. But you know, within the family, was this history preserved? I mean, did they knew who they were and knew where they had come from?
The great granddaughter tells me that in Ada King's house there was a K volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica with the page for Clarence King marked. But I don't think she grew up truly knowing just how famous her great-grandfather was.
Mm. Well, it's a really fascinating story, and if folks who would like to read more about it, the book to look for is Passing Strange, and the subtitle, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. It's published by the Penguin Press by our guest, Martha Sandweiss. She's professor of history at Princeton University. Before that, taught for 20 years at Amherst College. She's written a lot about Western American history and the history of photography, another interesting book you might want to look at if you are interested in either or both of those things. Is the book Print the Legend, Photography in the American West. And she is also co-editor of the Oxford History of the American West. And Professor Sandweiss, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, David. I enjoyed it.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, a show we first broadcast in February of 2009. You'd like to listen to other past shows, go to will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring the exhibit Helen May Butler and Her Ladies, the New American Brass Band from the Smithsonian Institute. More information is at sousaarchives.org. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
That's it for Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, sitting in today for Celeste Quinn, Tom Rogers.
And good afternoon, David. Well, a minute before good afternoon, good morning yet. And the Afternoon Magazine continues in the noon hour with Europe Today from the BBC. And in about 40 minutes or so, Jeff Bosser will be talking with author and columnist Will Leach. His book, Are We Winning? The Fathers and Sons in the Golden Age of Baseball. That's coming up. And our last forecast from AM580's Mike Sola. In the markets right now, things have taken a bit of a nosedive as we head into the holiday weekend, particularly in corn because of good weather and and other factors. July wheat in Kansas City, though, is down 7.5 cents, 4.85 and a quarter right now. July wheat in Chicago is down 8.5 cents at 4.59 and a quarter a bushel. Corn for July at 3.63, down 10 and a quarter cents. September down 10 and three quarters at 3.72 and a half. December corn 3.83 and a quarter, down 10 and